How you see the clock rolling?
Yeah, thanks.
Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for your word. We desperately need it. We thank you that you have chosen to reveal yourself in it, and I thank you for these men who want to learn well how to understand it, how to handle it, apply it to their own hearts. And Lord, I ask that you bless our time this morning in Jesus' name. Amen.
You seem like you got way more energy than the man who was inside of you there.
He weren't seen. Crack cocaine.
It's not. I was gonna get out by the door or something.
Scrub that.
What in the world is going on?
What do you need, Josh?
My pin cap came off. And you know when something falls and it's like way over there somewhere? My pin cap. And I'm looking for it. And
I'd bend over, but I don't think I can.
You're good, bro.
I tried to put on my shoes earlier.
I think it'll be over there. I dropped it, it came off.
That's
what
popped it. Matt, I'm so sorry you had to see it that way. Your truck is brown.
I didn't want green anyway when I bought it. That was just what they had on the lot.
Do you want me to do the verbs?
And, yeah.
Yeah, and the diagram?
Go ahead, give it all. Give it all to us.
Nice handwriting, man.
Thanks.
That's not typical engineer handwriting, is it?
You should see how he does his lessons. There's fonts and colors.
No, that's Cameron.
Or Cameron
does different fonts in her handwriting.
In her
hand, it's
like,
crazy.
Like, for real fonts. And I'm like, you hand wrote that? It's crazy.
Since we got married.
Does she have names for them?
No. Yeah, Georgia area. Yeah, since she got married, she's like, worked to have better handwriting than me. And she did it. I put the brackets over here because I added the U later.
That's great.
So.
Any questions, disagreements?
I wasn't sure about the according to.
Yeah, that's the trick in this one. Does it say prep over both of those?
Yeah.
Yeah. According to is a preposition.
What?
According to.
Good job, man.
So, if you just have one word prep over both of those, that's fine. If you put prep over both of them.
Is that one word in Hebrew?
In Greek, yeah. Or in Hebrew, yes. Yeah, it would be.
It's tough.
It's a prepositional phrase, right?
It's a prepositional phrase. Anybody have something different? Or according and to
an adverb.
I understood that they both were functioning as prepositions, but I didn't know what to do with according to make it one thing. And
yeah.
So I'm like, well, to your word, prepositional phrase, object of preposition, according. And I knew according was acting as an adverb. And so it ended up kind of diagramming similarly. mean, it had the same point. It was modifying rebut, but...
Yeah.
I didn't put the part of speech of the prepositions. Up to the dust and according to your word. What they're acting as.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What kind of prepositional phrase? Yeah. And what... What is this one?
Adverb.
Or the other?
Adverb. So would it be adverb? Is it functioning as that?
The whole phrase is.
Oh, okay.
That's where you put the thing over the top.
Yeah.
Okay. It's an adverb. Okay.
Because I read that prepositional phrases can also act as objects of prepositions.
Don't wish that in the book.
I said that in the book. So I think probably these exception cases.
Did it give an example?
I don't remember. So how would...
Let's see. I like... To my room. I can't think of an example. I tried for like 15 seconds.
I have...
It's impossible then.
What's that?
I had according to what my H3 pass.
Oh, yeah.
It's in the song, Songs Be to God.
We jumped from off the tower.
According to is in the prep song?
Yeah.
Sweet.
We jumped from off the tower.
That's good.
Yeah, and yeah. in the barn was her favorite place to hide. That's it acting as a, I guess object of the preposition and then a subject.
Now, and what I would do with from off, I would treat that as a single preposition. Because from and off are both relating to your movement in a direction related to the tower. You can see it that you are moving from a position of off the tower, but that's not really the idea of what's trying to be conveyed. You are departing the tower from it and off it. You're not departing a situation of being off the tower. If you were departing the situation of being off the tower, you'd be getting on the tower. So I don't really like that.
How would you diagram that?
I don't know. I don't know how they would diagram that. But I don't like classifying the prepositional phrase as an object there of the other preposition. I think you have a word, a preposition that's made up of two words, which is much more easy to digest.
So, unless you knew according to was one was a prepositional whole, how would you?
You would just get it wrong. In fact, grammar is like that. There are all kinds of silly little nuanced rules that until you get it
just
wrong,
get
you
it wrong.
Never know.
You just get it wrong.
No, I mean the point of all of this, you guys are getting a combination of what I use to diagram in order to understand a text, and you guys are learning sort of my system, which is a conglomeration of several different things. But the point here is you understand the relationships between the words. So someday you will come across something in a text that we will not have covered in this class.
No. So, will there be another class for that?
What are you going to do then?
Call you.
And you can. You can call me because I'm always interested in like exceptional grammar stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Is woven expletive?
Yes. It depends on how you use it.
Isaiah 6.
Yes. Well.
What? Me is woe? Wouldn't that be me as woe?
It's not an expletive.
Is it a predicate adverb?
It can't be with the to be verb.
Predicate adjective?
Yeah.
I am woe.
Is he saying, my name is woe? Mm-hmm. That's old English. I don't even know what's intended by woe is me. Woe is me.
I am woe.
It's not good grammar.
I am woe.
I am woe. So I'd be interested in like the history of that phrase. I think
woe to you.
More modern, we say to. Woe to me.
Woe to you.
Which then you're making woe the subject, be the implied verb, to me.
And our woe is different than that woe. Isn't it?
Whoa.
Besides, whoa.
Yeah, Bill and Ted woe is not the same thing as Isaiah.
Curse. Curse.
Yeah, curse does me.
Cursed am I. Or cursings be to me.
Stop it, man.
Okay. Who hasn't been to the ward yet? Who would like to take us to the ward? JG, you got
thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. If you can insert the preposition to or for to get the idea, that usually is a good indicator given a direct object.
So there's going to be brackets around it.
He kicked me the ball.
He kicked me the ball. Yeah, that's a great one. The ball is a direct object.
But it's not a
me is the indirect object. So and you can insert he kicked to me the ball to make it make sense.
So it's a
great
clause.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate that.
I guess the brackets.
Because you I don't know. He kicked me the ball. He didn't kick me.
Mm-hmm. I was like that conventional phrase that I was like.
It's got something.
Would that just be like a like in Greek, would it just be a dative noun? Or is it actually like
the according to or the or to
the first part though, the to the best.
Yeah, I didn't look at it in Hebrew.
I don't know what it is. You revived me according to your word. I didn't like it being a command. I don't know.
You didn't like that it was?
It seemed odd. It seemed odd that I'd be commanding God to revive me. Is it a command, actually?
It was a command?
You hadn't heard
it. You hadn't.
I know. I was just changing it.
If it wasn't, in English, if it weren't imperative, the you would have been supplied. So, and there are cases where the translators make an interpretive decision, and they make a command, an indicative, and they supply the you. Because sometimes the Greek form looks exactly the same as an imperative or an indicative. And you have to determine by context.
I felt a little uncomfortable writing that.
Well, do you pray?
Yeah.
You're commanding God all the time?
Yeah.
Pleading with Him. Father, forgive me. I'm commanding you. You know what's interesting about... I was talking to Janet about this a while back. When we are asking God to save someone, there's some audacity in that. I mean, we're essentially asking God to transfer rightful wrath due a sinner and transfer it to His beloved Son who never did anything wrong.
Oh, right here?
I mean, there's something just completely wrong about the cross anyway. But pleading with God to forgive, which is He came to save. So it's like it's right, and yet it's costly. It's infinitely costly, and it's just a very strange thing what God has done. So, the grass coming to my house last night was providential. We've been praying for this guy down the street, Cliff. Cliff's got a goatee down to about here. I moved from Nashville to here and found some Nashville, not Nashville, but like outlying areas type of area.
You're calling the backwoods, aren't you?
He is a sweet guy. He's got like six cars in different pieces in the in his backyard. He's got a 1931 Model A or something in the garage. Whoa. But he's got like six Chevy trucks in various stages of, I don't know if they're coming together.
Disrepair
or repair, one of those. And But I couldn't get a wave out of him ever since we moved there, like September. See him, you know, 2-3 times a week. Couldn't get him to respond. And then one day I went and got the mail. And I always go get the mail on the skateboard. Every once in a while I have the kids with me. So Janet's skateboard's like extra long. And so I had Zoe and Emmett riding on the front. So I'm kicking down the street, Zoe and Emmett riding on the skateboard. And to go get the mail, Cliff stops me and says, "Hey," he said, "Hey, you know, there's a big like skate show like this weekend." And he starts talking about something, and so we started talking. And I've been praying for him, but ever since then, like, he waves to me.
Oh,
it's like changed the dynamic. So last night, the sod truck pulls up, and like, no, the driver must have thought I was crazy. No one has ever been as excited to see grass as I was yesterday. I ran in and got the kids. Catch, the grass is here. The grass is here. We came out. Emmett loves trailers and trucks. I'll come out and watch the guy unload the grass into our driveway. And, okay, kids, get to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we started. It's 6:30. And Clint drove by a cliff. He reminds me of somebody else. Cliff.
Named Clint, I hope.
Cliff drove by at like 9:30, waved, and even honked. It's like, man, that's awesome. Things are really stepping up. Well, a half hour later, he shows up on foot in my driveway and says, "Eat a ham." And he's got like a 24 pack of beer. And
nice.
I'm like, I said, you brought the beer and you're offering to help? Man, this is awesome.
No wonder it took so long.
And, and so, like, for 2 hours last night, he helped me lay sod, and we got to talk about the gospel, and it was really cool.
Hmm. Did you drink a beer?
No. Yeah. I don't like the taste.
Yeah, me.
And I didn't want my grass crooked.
Yeah, missed a spot.
Okay, I got to start. I'm confused. I have as the heart as a preposition. Is that right? But I also have as a subordinate conjunction.
Okay. Okay. What's your as can be a preposition. Both like and as can function that way.
But here it's not, right?
But here it's not, and why is it not?
It's not describing.
Let's back up. What's the verb in that clause?
Was devoted.
Okay, was devoted. But you have two verbs in the clause.
Had been.
Had been. What's the subject of was devoted?
His heart.
It's part. Okay. What's the subject of had been?
David's heart.
There you go. if it's the heart you just pointed at, it can't be inside the prepositional phrase because that would make it off limits.
Right.
So don't make it a prepositional phrase.
Dang.
Make as like you said, as a subordinating conjunction.
Run through the off limits.
The heart of David, his father had been as a clause.
Inside a prepositional phrase,
yeah.
The words inside are off limits, but the whole thing inside the phrase is being used as an adjective or adverb. That whole phrase is
an
adjective or an adverb.
A verb to me that is another clause, but I did like a little dotted line thing and just made it.
Is it?
It was like.
yeah, let's walk through our verbs.
I had for example, a phrase for some moment. Moment.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's
exactly right. Yeah, it's like I went through everything that I knew, and then
yeah.
I left that blank. I'm like, but there's a verb, so how does that work?
Yeah, so it has to.
So it has to.
Is the devoted okay. Implied again? Had been.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was my question.
Yeah, and if you inserted that,
if you didn't
just
insert
like
it
in parentheses, so
in good. Parentheses, should, and you should.
You
yes.
should insert it.
By the way,
another one.
Psalm 119, was there not for its grammatical trickery?
But for your heart.
But for your heart. So, if your soul has been cleaving to the dust of sentence diagramming,
it did call my heart. So I just flowed right through it.
Great.
There was no frustration in my heart.
Okay, are those all the verbs? You've got was, turned, was, we're missing, was devoted. Have been devoted.
So the number of verbs should indicate how many clauses you have.
Should.
Okay.
You can have multiple verbs with one subject. I galloped and ran.
How do you guys run that?
Same way we split.
Oh, you just split it. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Man, I didn't have devoted as a verb.
If you had it as a predicate adjective, that's okay. That's okay.
It's all relative.
What you would find is typically in Greek or Hebrew, that's the has been devoted is going to be all one word. And it's going to be a verb. But in English, it's ambiguous. To be a verb with a sort of past participle, I think like an adjective.
Well,
just an adjective. We have a lot of words like that.
Okay. I
the devoted friend. I was devoted. You could treat it as an adjective.
Because I thought about if I was trying to say that I was using, if my heart was a verb devoted, I might have, like my heart was devoting, but it would change the tense. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I would almost phrase it differently. My heart was, was devoted makes it, I thought more, sounds more like an adjective.
It can, because we have the adjective devoted, but it can go both ways. Yeah. You have to have a way to be able to say that in the past tense.
Yeah.
Is holy an adverb or adjective? Have it as
because adverbs modify what?
As verbs. I have it as an adjective.
Okay. Adverbs modify what?
Verbs.
And?
Adverbs and adjectives and it's modifying devoted. Okay. I'm an idiot.
Just wrong.
Is your soul cleaving to the dust?
It is, bro.
My soul cleaves to the dust. Okay. Yeah, are we good here? Okay, let's just do clause by clause. Go ahead, Matt.
If we're going clause by clause, then.
Okay, let's start with first clause.
So are we saying that's all right now?
We'll work our way through
okay.
it. You'd like to bicker, wouldn't you?
That's what I was about to.
Okay, great. Does everybody understand why JG picked that as the first clause?
Because it's the main.
Yeah. When here can function as a temporal adverb or a temporal particle, a subordinating conjunction. Calling it a subordinating conjunction is probably the easiest way to go. Okay, so his wives turned his heart away after other gods when Solomon was old. All right, go ahead and give us the second one.
Oh.
So
go ahead. You have 10 questions.
After other gods, so adverb or adjectival? Heart.
Yeah, good question. Why don't you talk it out? Make it adjectival. What would it sound like?
Where is heart turned to? Turned to other gods?
But now, see, you're including the verb, turned. To. Where as an adverb type question? You'd have to say what kind? What kind of heart is it? It's an after other gods heart. Which, you know, might be true by idea, but not true grammatically.
Okay.
How are we doing? So far, so good?
Can you put the when psalm in as old as before? Kind of just point back?
Yeah, you can, but you're going to have to indicate somehow that it is actually subordinate to the one that follows. This is the whole tension of it's grammatically subordinate, but the word order, we have to swap the word order to show it. If you kept the word order the same, which is good, and I want to do that as often as I can, you got to show somehow that this actually is subordinate to what follows.
If I drew a line that said subordinate to.
That's very clear. That'll work.
Maybe in.
It is. Cross.
No.
Cross.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I moved it. Because and isn't coordinating with the Solomon was old, right? And coordinating with the wives.
We will have to determine that. Great question. That is an exegetical decision that we will have to make. JG has staked his claim in yet to be determined territory. He seems pretty confident about it, though.
Yep. It may be blind, but I own it.
Only in America.
This draws with me.
What kind of heart?
Oh, yeah. You're in the room. It's not going to work.
Just give us heart. You can give us heart on the other part of the board and then
okay.
Show us what you did.
For us to have those words in opposition, like Lord and God, and David and Father.
That's what I did too.
Yeah, you should. Yep. As opposed to inserting another prepositional phrase, because we're not intending to say. To Yahweh and to his God. We're not trying to coordinate prepositional phrases. We're renaming Yahweh.
You had them as adjectives under the Lord.
Okay. I thought that was what happened.
Okay. Is God an adjective?
Well, I had it as a noun adjective.
A noun adjective.
Noun adjective.
That's good.
So when you're diagramming your apposition and like there's like his is a possessive pronoun and his is an adjective on God,
uh-huh.
How do you put the?
Let's do it.
The book has an equal sign.
Yeah, equal sign is great. I sort of grew up doing something like an equal sign. If you have an equal sign, that's great. So it would look like this. The Lord.
Okay.
Is wow. God. You can do that.
Where would you put that in, Pastor?
So, holy devoted to.
Dang.
So, Lord
because
and.
What this indicates is he was holy devoted to two people. Right? What this indicates is he was holy devoted to one person, or not holy devoted, and that person is named Yahweh here, and.
is God there.
So do you just put apposition above both names? How do you do that?
What do you mean?
When you wrote it out, is that correct?
Uh huh. That's what the diagram should look like for apposition.
In the above things, we put noun apposition.
Up here, you would just say, where is it? So this should simply be it's interesting. The whole thing's adverbial, right? Where was he devoted? In what realm was he devoted? Noun, object of the preposition, noun, object of the preposition, possessive pronoun.
So you don't indicate that position in...
Nope, you do it down here in the diagram. And the same thing's true over here on David, his father. So, heart of... It's not the heart of David and the heart of somebody else. It's one heart of one person. And if you did an equal sign, that's fine too. Apposition can be done as the subject of a sentence. I, Paul, prisoner of Lord, the Lord.
Is there a limit on how many nouns can be in a position to be said?
Paul didn't think so.
Me. Yeah. I. Paul.
I, Paul, the apostle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The limit is 7.2.
Okay.
You go over that, you're busted.
Dang. It's hoping for 490. Verbs, right?
Yeah, everybody got the verbs?
Wait, turned is past?
Simple past.
Is it active?
Past, active, indicative.
Turned, active.
His wives passing. Turned his heart. The dog chased the ball. The man kicked the dog. What, were you thinking it might be passive?
Yeah.
Make it passive.
His wives turned his heart.
No. Very clever.
When Solomon is old, as in he was old, back then his wife turned his heart back then.
Okay. You're trying to make it something about tense. But we're talking over here about voice, active or passive. Active voice means the subject is doing the action. Who's the subject? Wives. Are they doing the turning? Yes. Now, what is being turned?
Solomon.
His heart. Okay, now make his heart the subject, but convey the same idea.
His heart was turned by the wives.
That's passive.
Okay.
Everybody guess that?
Get that.
Okay. What about the second one? Was... simple to be verb, to be verb, past, indicative, was devoted.
When you put was devoted in the little verb tree there,
yeah.
I always put the not.
You can. I won't
include
count.
It in there, but.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can do that. It's not going to change voice, tense, and mood.
Okay.
Okay. Was devoted.
And if you just put was?
If you just put was, it's going to be past indicative. If you put was devoted,
it's so much easier to put was. this is supposed to be hard work.
Yeah, just past. Okay. Simple past. And then had been devoted. Past perfect, right?
Is it past perfect progressive?
Whoa, progressive.
You wouldn't, that would be an impossible tense, I think. If you did past progressive or past or what's it also called, the imperfect, it would sound like his heart was being devoted or something like that.
Okay.
Or if you said something different, you'd say he was devoting his heart. That would be the past progressive or the imperfect. Here, you're saying it had been devoted. Remember, perfect, you've got perfect, you've got past perfect, and you've got future perfect. Okay? From the standpoint of the author, past perfect looks like this. Okay? A past activity, from reference of the, we'll say this is today, right now. Okay? This is right now. Perfect looks like this. I don't know. Future perfect, from this standpoint of the speaker, okay, so past perfect, I had climbed the, I had cleaned the house. Let me do another different one. I had taken out the trash. Okay, is the trash still empty? Doesn't sound
not
like
in my
it.
House.
Doesn't sound like it. We don't know. But at some point in time in the past, I took out the trash, and it had continuing results into some other time in the past, but now we're in the present. We haven't said anything about the current state. Okay? Perfect, or present perfect, I have taken out the trash. Is the trash still empty? Yes. Past activity with continuing results into the present. We have been justified. Romans 5:1. Present perfect. Past action with continuing results into the present. Praise the Lord. Future perfect. I will have taken out the trash. Is the trash empty or full right now?
Full.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, we're assuming it's the safe assumption. It's full. I will have taken it out. At some point in the future, I'm going to do something that's going to have continuing results past that activity.
What about had been seen?
Had been seen. Good.
Seeing.
I'm seeing. Oh, have been seeing?
Have been seeing.
Wow.
I had saw?
Yeah. I had been seeing.
Saw that.
Something. Okay. Yeah, what is the tense?
Past perfect progressive. According to the
book. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Wow.
Because you're talking about a past activity that has not carrying into the present that was a progressive activity. Yeah.
So it was past.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Imperfect.
It wasn't just past perfect, it was past perfect something.
He's progressive.
Progressive, okay.
Progressive.
Is that in the verb section, Eric?
Past perfect, imperfect.
The verb section.
You're ever going to say has been.
No, this is probably why he uses progressive instead of like the Greek terminology of imperfect, because it allows you to qualify this one more step. I would simply categorize that as past perfect. And then go on to say, what kind of activity was this? Was this a progressive activity or an iterative activity or whatever, further define that.
And so,
when you're talking Greek, you'll talk about simple tense, and then you'll say, there are 16 different functions of the perfect tense. Which one is this? And they'll talk about progressive or iterative or whatever. So he's including that in tense in the discussion about tense. But
okay,
not all grammarians will do that. That's not illegitimate.
That's.
But it's a lot more things to try to remember.
Yeah, it's like, it seems like whatever source you go to has a different way of. No one grammarian is the same.
No. It's true. And if you talk to some grammarians in this room, you can have things like noun adjectives, which is just awesome.
That's they make it easier.
Oh. They make it easier. Let's talk about this a little bit. We need to determine the coordination. What's coordinating to what? We'll start with the view that says, if you hold the view that this and coordinates heart was devoted with wives turned heart. Speak up. Tell us why. Sell it. Matt.
Sell it? Because there was an and there, and they're right next to each other.
Okay.
That works for me.
But talk it through. What would it sound like out loud if we made that decision?
Well, I felt like that they both were, like, when Solomon was old, there were two things that happened.
Okay.
The wives turned his heart against the Lord, and his heart was not wholly devoted. Even as I say it out loud, that says, therefore his heart was not fully devoted. So.
If it was like his wives turned his heart away from after the other gods when his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord, it would be like his heart was already turned away then. So mm-hmm. What did his wives add to it?
Yeah.
To the turning.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Something's being said here that sort of demands, I think, the way J.G. had it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would leave it there. And that's one of the reasons that I reversed the word order to get the subordination, because that helps make that even more clear. Okay. What was happening three chapters prior? Give me some context.
He's building a temple.
Yeah, dedication of the temple. Remember Solomon's prayer there? Let's look at that a little bit. Just sort of scan that, take a look at that, and find some contrasts for me between 1 Kings 8 and 1 Kings 11.
So the hand should be on the same line as when? Is that what you said? It should be indented?
It should be, yeah, right here.
With when?
These two crosses should be on the same. Because we're coordinating these two together.
So then, would and have to be a subordinating conjunction?
It was all
coordinate.
Because it's coordinating to this.
But then they're both subordinating.
Order.
Yeah.
But that would make them both subordinating to wives turned his heart.
So they turned his heart when he was old, and when his heart was not fully devoted to him.
It turned his heart when he was old, and when he was old, his heart was not devoted.
Well, then it would be subordinate.
No, but I'm just confused now.
Yeah, but what Matt's saying is you brought the when down here to govern both, and it should if that's true. The and here almost brings about a consequence, and so, and therefore, it's the Hebrew and is very versatile and conveys all kinds of subordinating ideas.
So we're trying to say that those two clauses there, wives turned his heart away after other gods, and heart was not wholly devoted, that the second one is more a consequence of the first. Mm-hmm. That those two ideas don't stand in parallel. One follows the other.
Right.
So would that mean that it's not a coordinating conjunction?
Yes. Yeah. It seems to be functioning with some consequence.
Right.
Okay, so how do we represent that?
I think the way you have this, the way you have a diagram there.
Circle the and.
Represent that. Okay. If you, I'm not going to mark it wrong. If you coordinated it out to the far left, or when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away, and his heart was. If you coordinated, his wives turned his heart away, and his heart was not wholly devoted, because of the and there, I'm not going to mark that wrong. Grammatically, that's correct.
So are we saying that and here needs to be, that bottom clause needs to be indented? Is that the idea?
I'm saying if you had this up here, and you had this and coordinating these two together, and it was out, okay. Not indented. Okay. I'm not going to mark that wrong. I think we have to ask the question and make a decision based on. In this case, it's in Hebrew you're going to run into this. In Greek, you will not run into this problem. I think, I'm pretty sure, just because the Hebrew conjunction is so flexible, especially in narrative, that you can have a subordinating idea in the simple hand.
Would you see? When I was talking through it a couple minutes ago, I said "and therefore," and that's what drove me.
Yeah, and I think that's the idea.
It seems like when Solomon was old is just stating like the two clauses that follow. One is stating it positively, his heart was turned, and the other is stating it negatively, his heart was not devoted to God. So it's almost restating the same thing with reference to Solomon's heart and where his heart's devotion went.
That's how I diagrammed it.
It could, or the not wholly devoted is a consequence of being turned.
I was thinking more in terms of like responsibility. I think, like on the one hand, his wives turned his heart. On the other hand, his heart wasn't devoted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could make a case. You could make a case idea-wise for either way. Like, his heart was turnable because it was not fully devoted, and so his wives took advantage of that. You could make a case idea-wise. The question is going to be, what did the author intend? What did the biographer of Solomon's life intend by this? And I think this is why I want to bring out what's going on in chapter 8. What do you see there in that prayer?
There's a lot.
It's a fantastic prayer.
Verse 23, O God, O Yahweh, God of Israel, there is no God like you.
Yeah.
Chase these other ones.
Yeah. Three chapters later, Baal, Chemosh, Molech. Yeah, they'll do too. And whose gods were those three?
The gods of his wives.
And he was now devoted not to Yahweh and Yahweh alone, but to gods where they would, you know, burn their firstborn on the red hot glowing bronze arms of a statue. I mean, it's despicable.
He's found in verse 46. If they sin against you, for there is no one who does not sin, and you are angry with them and give them to an enemy, so that they are carried away captive to the land of the enemy, far off or near, yet if they turn their heart into the land.
Yeah. Here's what's interesting. That reveals his bibliology was good. He knew the book of Deuteronomy, which said that very thing was going to happen. He knew his theology proper. He had his anthropology right. Tell me about his theology proper in this book.
Theology proper.
Yeah, like God, his Godology. What did he know to be true about God? Especially related to this little box he was constructing. The you know, one of the wonders in the ancient world was Solomon's temple. It's a fantastic building. What does he say about the building? It's not big enough. And would the heavens and the highest heavens be big enough? No. the universe is not big enough to contain you, and yet I'm building you this little box. That's pretty good theology. And it wasn't very long before he was bowing down to other gods, building altars even for them. This is remarkable. This is remarkable for the power of the influence. Here's the moral of the story. Women are bad. They're just evil.
Wow.
I think in 57b, may he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to him, to walk in all his ways and keep his commandments, his statutes, and his rules, which he commanded our fathers.
Yeah. What a great request.
61, let your heart therefore be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in statutes and keep his commandments.
And who's he talking to?
The people
of Israel. He's being a good shepherd, king type of guy right here. I mean, he is leading the people well.
In chapter 10, right before he turns from God, it says, now Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen, and he had a bunch of chariots, a bunch of horsemen. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. You know, which goes back to Deuteronomy.
Yeah, you will multiply horses and
wives. You can't have a lot of wives, you can't have a lot of gold, silver. Don't go to Egypt. And I think it says even, he imported horses from Egypt.
Yeah.
Just looking at the verse, it almost seems like his heart was turned after other gods when he was old. But it's like he has all these wives in the past. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the point here, when Solomon was old, now look at his life. Fast forward, look at his life. Look what has happened. It's not that Solomon, this was here. It's not Solomon turned old, whatever age that is, and then bam, his foreign wives turned his heart and he's worshiping other gods. It's when he was old, now look where he's gone. Look where he's ended up.
I hope you learned all that was vain.
if only we had some record. How great that God included a book like Ecclesiastes in the Bible to see a picture of that repentance.
You got like 300 wives. You're tugging at your heartstrings.
Guys, what in our lives has the potential to make us build an altar to Molech?
Technology.
Anything that demands a lot of your time. Because when you invest a lot of time in something, you feel like you need to make it worthwhile in your heart. And in my life, when I find something that consumes a lot of my time, that becomes an idol in my heart. And I have to make sure that those are good things, because otherwise I will follow after those things. I know my own heart is weak in that area.
Apple has been revealing some idols in my heart. Has your brother Matt been helping with that? A little bit.
What else?
You know, I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, if you look at this verse, there is like this interpretive, like, was his heart also not wholly devoted to the Lord at the same time?
Okay.
You know, do you have the potential to turn because your heart's not wholly devoted to the Lord?
Well, was his heart not wholly devoted, and that's how he allowed the wives to come in the first place?
Let's talk about that.
Right.
Okay. So here's 1 Kings 8. Here's his prayer. Solomon's heart is pointed, and we'll just call this dot over here, like, he's a faithful king to Yahweh all his days. Okay? And there's a line, a heart trajectory line that finishes the race well, that runs the race all the way through well, right? Over here, He's in the Valley of Hinnom, burning his sons to a foreign god. That is like worlds apart. This dot up here is like, it's just miles and miles and miles away from faithfulness to Yahweh. Solomon didn't run like that, did he? The line goes like this. And right here, a hard trajectory that's aiming away from Yahweh and a hard trajectory that is aiming to faithfulness to Yahweh is really, really close. In fact, it's hard to tell them apart. Right? They looks a lot the same. And right here, dude is going to Grace Bible Church, teaching communion. He's in hermeneutics class. He's teaching next generation ministries. He's leading family devotions at home. He's it's hard to tell where that dot is right there, but his heart's pointing right there, and you get down that road. Guys, we have got to watch the trajectories of our hearts. And not have all of our attention like here. You and I ought to be terrified when we're right here and it's pointing the wrong way. Just pointing the wrong way. Guys, I see wayward trajectories in my heart all the time. You want to fight them. You want to fight them back here. It's harder to fight them down here when that space gets bigger. You guys ever try to fight them farther down that road? Turning that ship is difficult.
I know that one thing I was hoping with this class was that I would be able to take the verses and passages that we'd be covering, and I would make those devotional for trying to be efficient with time and everything, set aside what I was doing that was devotional and try to use these as devotional. And what I've learned over the last like week and a half is that hasn't been so. For one of the reasons that it hasn't been so is because I don't know if I got it right, and therefore I don't want to like so it's like 2 days ago I recognized it. It's like, no, I need something. If that's not going to be devotional, I need something that's going to be devotional. So I set aside more time to do that.
What I think is really significant about this picture is we need to be able to recognize the indicators that show us that we're starting to follow another trajectory. And the Lord's good. He'll show us whether it's vocabulary or whether it's the way in which we behave. He'll begin to show us and give us indicators that we're on that other trajectory. We can't ignore them. We have to respond when the Lord shows us signs that our heart is beginning to shift and trend towards another God.
What are some of the ways that he does that?
Sometimes when I hear myself talking to my wife or my kids, it's a sign that, and it's not one of my better days, it's a sign that something else inside me is, my affection is on something else other than the task to which I've been called. When I mention my time, when I'm spending my time inordinately on something that I know is not what God has for me, that's a sign that I've set something else before me, that I've made an idol in my heart.
For me, it was an impatience and a lack of prayer on like specific decisions and things, not being prayerful over those decisions, and then the way that then those affected other people, and the way that impatience then manifested.
do the people close to you, men, see when the arrow's pointing the wrong way sooner than you might?
By Jenna, then yes.
Guys, your wife is such a gift from the Lord.
Absolutely, bro.
She's got radar for trajectory errancy, right? She knows it. And even if she can't articulate it, she'll ask a question or make a funny face, or maybe you incite her to an elevated tone because you had an elevated tone you didn't realize, and there's a whatever it is, you know when your wife is reacting to your heart being out of place. It's hard for your wife to respond sinfully when your heart is like dead on. It's just you create temptation for your wife when your heart trajectory is in the wrong place. That's a gift. That's a good thing in the sense that here's a what is a Geiger counter, right? For your heart. That's your wife.
Huh. It's that little rod on the bottom of the car ride at Disneyland that when you start to crawl. I just keep coming back and forth.
Yes. Yeah. Your kids can do that too. They don't know that they are indicating for you when your heart is errant. They're not trying to do that, but they look at you funny when you're out of sorts and you're not responding the way that you should. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
When your kids come to you and say, "Dad, I think we need to pray."
I remember the first time that our daughter was like, "Dad, you do not speak with kindness." I'm like, "You're right.
Don't tell me. Anything else about Solomon or his heart?
With the sentence diagram we did draw up too, if you just look at the main thing, wives turned heart, heart was devoted, yeah. Heart had been devoted. It's just all centered around the heart.
Isn't that good? Yeah, the heart is under the clause. On the top line. Well, except Solomon's old.
This isn't relative to the diagram, but when I consider how many concubines he took, 700, he didn't take them all at once. I'm probably pretty sure that he didn't just go to Egypt and import the most.
Concubines are us. 700. Yeah.
700. econcubine.com. He did this in steps, you know. Maybe he grabbed it in bunches, but to get that many, he had to do it again and again and again. And that tells us that he missed the indicators the first time. And when he missed it the first time, it brazened and hardened his heart. Just that much more to do again.
He told us the eyes of man are never satisfied. I think that speaks to his collection of women.
Yeah, you can out Solomon, right? Read the book of Ecclesiastes and look at all the stuff that he chased, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. He had all of it to a greater degree than anybody else. He had the capacity to have whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. Nobody's been that wealthy. And Solomon found all of it in one thing. Ephesians 5:1. What does it say?
Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. Should we write this down?
I nerded it up in time right now while Scott was preaching.
Did you?
I did. My wife was like,
okay. Talk to me about voice, tense, and mood.
Present.
Imperative.
Active. Oh, B, yeah, sorry.
Did Scott bring up the grammar?
Yeah.
You nerded up the sermon by diagramming it while you... But... you were able to do that because of the way he preached, right? Did it feel like he was being all grammatical and technical and, you know, for the non-grammatically initiated, would this have been like, whoosh, what did he do? What did he do with this? Didn't he talk about that for like 15 minutes? Did you guys feel the force of a present imperative?
Yeah.
Did he stand up there and say, now, this is a present imperative, which means it's a present. What did he do? How did he make you feel present imperative?
Illustration of mimicking somebody, going to bed, reading stories to your kids, brushing your teeth, waking up.
He talks about doing it 24/7.
Did you feel that? That was good. Like, he was, when he was doing that, he was talking grammar. He was bringing out the grammar right there. But he was doing it in such a way that nobody had any clue, except you guys, what he was doing.
Stood out to me in a hurry. Same with Josh's communion. I'm like, boy, that just reeks of this human hermeneutics class.
Big time. Yeah. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. Yeah, I mean, but
the Word was.
I mean, it didn't feel like a grammar lecture. This whole issue with the present imperative, you would get tired of somebody, of everyone would get tired of you being in character and imitating somebody. There's only one person worthy to be imitated all the time, and it's God. And that is the force of this. You and I need to imitate God 24/7. That's what this is calling us to. That was really good.
I also thought it was really good because just reading it, you could tend to be focused on the adverbial prepositional phrase.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people could be tempted just to look there and be focused on that in a relationship. And I like how he focused so long on the other. And then it was like, you're like, and where it has beloved children. And then it was like this.
Yeah.
It was like turning that.
Yep. Yeah.
Good.
An excellent example, and Josh, yours too, communion message. Just an excellent example of the grammar helped you determine the meaning, but you delivered in such a way that we weren't thinking grammar. We were all saying, this passage is so clear. That's what you're supposed to do when you're teaching God's word, is make it clear. Let it be clear. Anyway, excellent. Those were excellent. Let's talk genre for just a few moments. We'll have time to introduce what we're going to talk about in detail Friday. What I want to do today is just introduce the idea and let you guys brainstorm a little bit. Genre is one of those technical literary words. Maybe when you were dating your wife, you used it in a sentence to make her think you were sophisticated or something. I don't know. What is genre? What does it mean? A type?
Oh, no, those are mine.
Okay. Give me an example of a literary... give me an example of a musical genre.
Hip-hop.
Rock.
Soul.
Okay. Give me some examples of a literary genre.
Poetry.
Okay.
Didactic.
Okay. What about like an English lit? What are some genres?
Mystery.
Okay. You're saying that Shakespearean literature is its own genre?
Plays.
Okay, plays.
Fiction?
Nonfiction? Nonfiction. Biography. There are sets and subsets of genres.
Poetry.
Okay.
Apocalyptic.
No.
Oh no. Am I gonna lose my star?
you had one, you would.
How long have I been with you?
So apocalyptic, is that not?
It doesn't seem like it. That's the feeling like I'm getting JG.
It's not old English form of literature.
It does seem like it's a form of literature, or it was.
Yes.
But whether or not it's in the Bible is the question.
Were you not talking Bible yet?
Oh, no, Armageddon, the movie.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, you know, my favorite genre, my second favorite genre of movie is apocalyptic. So, like, what happens after the nuclear holocaust?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that type of stuff? Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I haven't seen it yet.
I want to
see it, because it's in my favorite genre. It
comes out today, I think.
Does it really?
DVD.
I'm not doing anything. Okay.
That's why he got the sod on. God knew.
That's right.
He pushed you.
That's why I came yesterday so I could watch it. I will be asleep. You know. I'll be asleep by 11 o'clock today. biblical genres. What are some of the biblical genres we're going to be doing?
Not apocalyptic.
we'll put apocalyptic up there. We just need to talk about it. Okay. Now that I've terrified you.
What about prophetic?
Okay.
Yeah, is that one?
What? Oh, I'm not trying to sting you.
Wisdom.
Narrative.
Poetry. History.
Didactic. Law. Or is that didactic?
Mystery.
Oh, wait. Did you say history or mystery?
History.
Mystery.
Mystery was revealed, right? It had to be somewhere.
History was caught.
Okay, you know what? They're guys will go crazy. One of my books talks about the importance of determining the genre, and even has a category for if there isn't a genre for it, you go ahead and make one up. And so Matt just did, and we might put like
similar to the
Matthew 13. Like there's a special kind of parable that Jesus tells if you get really subsetted in your genres, called, I don't know, Matt would call it mystery parable or parable. Judgment parable. Jesus, why are you speaking to these people in riddles? So that hearing they may not hear and seeing they may not see. Just as the prophet Isaiah said, you know, Matthew 13 takes a turn where Jesus goes from very public ministry to disciple only ministry for the rest of the book of Matthew. And he starts speaking to the crowds in these mystery parables that they can't understand, and Jesus explains them to his disciples. So maybe.
Gospel?
Epistle. Gospel. Epistle. Okay. Let's start with the big categories. What else do we have? Narrative, poetry, and maybe we might call it didactic. Okay, those are three sort of super headings. What are some special considerations that we might have? We're going to talk about how to deal with each of these next week in detail. Here's what you do with this. Here's what you do with that. Here's what you do with whatever. What are some special considerations we might have for narrative? Why are we talking about? Why would we talk about genre at all? Does it change the way we interpret? Does it change the way we look at words and their relationships?
Yes, because they're used differently.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe. Maybe not. Are we going to use a literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutic in all genres?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Does one of these genres change the way we interpret, Matt Dodd?
No.
No.
Thank you.
Do I get my star back?
Yes, you got it. Okay.
In poetry, they might not word things the same way.
Okay.
Like, they might not be as...
What are some characteristics of Hebrew poetry in particular?
Parallelism.
Parallelism is huge. We're going to talk about that.
Are there places where like they wouldn't use articles or
yes.
conjunctions?
Changes in the use of conjunctions, changes in the use of definite article, metaphoric language, literary structural devices like acrostics. Psalm 119 is an acrostic poem, right? You guys know that?
Oh, yeah.
And there are others.
That's why they have all the headings.
And even in your English Bible, it'll say Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. That's the Hebrew alphabet. And every, like in the Aleph section, every single line starts with the Hebrew letter A. Every single line. And every single line in the second section starts with B. And every line in the third section starts with G.
It's a lot more obvious in a Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, you wouldn't see it. There's a handful of acrostic poems. I can't remember how many there are. But there's a handful of acrostic poems in the Hebrew Bible. And Psalm 119 is the only one that the translator said, hey, this is an acrostic, I'm trying to tell you. The rest of them, it just doesn't translate.
That is cool.
And isn't the Book of Lamentations like that, except for the middle chapter?
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
Each chapter has 22 verses. And
yeah.
There's
some really interesting stuff going on in Hebrew poetry that it's hard to convey it in English. Although, English, by the way, is the best conveyor of Hebrew poetry of all known languages. Because English has a massive palette of words available to it compared with Latin, German, even Greek, and all kinds of other languages. English dwarfs every other language with its palette of words. So when Hebrew has a certain word with a certain nuance, the synonyms available in other languages are minimal, and the nuance might not even be available in Tagalog or Mibu or whatever. Whereas English is going to have many more available ones to pick the best possible synonym. And with all these synonyms available, English sometimes, the English translators of Hebrew poetry can actually sometimes match syllables. Hebrew sometimes uses onomatopoeia. What's onomatopoeia?
That's funny word.
I know what I've learned.
Isn't that like bark? Rough?
Yes. Ooh. It's the word itself actually sounds like the thing it's trying to convey.
Oh, yeah.
Growl.
Yes.
Yeah. Hiss. That kind of stuff. Okay. Hebrew uses onomatopoeia. And in the English language, you'll actually find onomatopoeia, whatever. You'll find words like that where the Hebrew has a word like that.
Huh.
Why, by the way, does the English language have such a bizarre, out of proportion palette?
Because it's a bastard.
It's like the Borg.
It
was formed out of...
Anybody?
I got it.
Yes!
People all the time will say, I hate English. The rules are... There's no rules. It seems like every time you have a rule, you have 20 different ways to break it, and it's just inconsistent. And think about our plurals, right? Oxen, boxen, or whatever. Why don't we just have simple S on everything? Why do we have to have all these different ways to do plurals? The reason for this is English is built on Saxon word order, which Saxon word order is subject, verb, object. Most languages are verb, subject, object, and most languages are what's the word when you make your verbs and nouns match each other and
polysynthetic.
Conjugation. They're conjugated. Conjugation. Is like in Spanish, didn't you have to learn your verb conjugations? Yeah. Who took Spanish? You had to learn like da 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 da.
Tienes, tenemos, tengo.
Yeah. And your nouns can be feminine, masculine, or neuter. Do you have neuter in Spanish?
Yeah. It's like that in German.
Okay. Most languages are like that. With Saxon word order and no conjugation, no case endings. That's the word I was looking for. No case endings. You have cases in Spanish, right? Cases in German, like if something is a subject or a nominative, it has a certain kind of case. Do you have nominative case in Spanish? Do you talk about that?
No, I don't think I got that far.
I think I'm pretty sure you're case endings. English, for the most part, doesn't have those kinds of things, which meant that English was free to incorporate words from all over the place. So English has Latin words, German words, Icelandic words, Eskimo words, you know, Navajo words. We have words from every other language because you didn't, like, what's a good example? Seraphim. Is seraphim singular or plural?
Plural.
Plural. Okay. What is singular of seraphim? Seraph. Now, why isn't it just seraphs? Where did we get the word seraph or cherub? We got it from Hebrew. We pulled in a Hebrew word and we kept the way Hebrew did singulars and plurals. So now English, and not only do we have oxen and boxen, but we have cherub and cherubim instead of just cherubs and oxes. Right? But that meant that English could just plug in words. When you have verb, subject, object, if you have...
God knew what he was doing.
Bit, dog, man. Who bit who?
Man. You can't tell.
You don't
bit,
know.
Dog, the man.
But you do know in other languages, because this is in a nominative case, and this is in a... accusative case, thank you. And the words actually change, so you have six different ways to say man, depending on where it falls grammatically in the sentence. Is it here, is it there, or is it over there? Right? Does that make sense? English doesn't change the cases, so we can use words like igloo and kayak without having to have a bunch of different case endings. Right? Kindergarten. You don't have to have a bunch of different case endings. So you just plug it in. And since instead of doing verb, subject, object, how do we know it's a subject? It usually goes in the front. The dog bit the man. How do we know the dog did the biting? Because it's in front of the verb. Anyway, all that to say, when you come to English, English gets a bad rap a lot of times, but conveniently, English is the best language to convey the Greek and Hebrew, Old and New Testament, and it is this is why English has been the vehicle by which Bible translation has gone all over the world and will continue to be, because it is able to catch the nuances better than any other language. Why in the world are we talking about that? Oh yeah, it's poetry. So there's things we need to look at with Hebrew poetry. The English does a better job than most people. Narrative. If there's one thing I want you to think about right now. Narrative is simply a statement that something happened. Somebody did something. The narrator is telling a story. Is everything in the Bible true?
Trick question.
Why is that a trick question?
I don't know, because you asked it in that way. I would say yes, hands down, everything is true.
I get it. Yeah.
Does everything that everybody says in the Bible agree with reality?
Yes.
No.
No.
Are there lies stated in the Bible?
Yes.
Yes.
Are there half-truths stated in the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
So the Bible is full of lies and half-truths.
No.
Does the Bible accurately record falsehoods stated by characters in the Bible?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. What that means for narrative, what that means for descriptive literature, is it is not prescriptive. Okay, it's not telling us to do something. Right? This is the fatal hermeneutical flaw of Wild at Heart. Anybody read Wild at Heart? Okay? What's the premise? What's the whole book based on? What's the exegetical basis of the book Wild at Heart?
Boys are... No. That's the other one. Wild at Heart is that, like, people are basically good, and you're, like, your experiences shape you into who you are, and it's a bunch of crap, basically.
Okay.
And
God's like, remember the first chapter? Where was Adam created?
I didn't pay a whole bunch of attention.
You remember?
In a garden.
Outside the garden.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Adam was placed in the garden after he was created. Eve, on the other hand, was made in the garden. What does that tell us? Huh. Man's wild at heart. I'm not kidding you. That's the exegetical basis for the book.
Wait a second.
And so to be a man, you know, grab a spear, get a loincloth, take your son into the woods and be wild. That's what the book's about. And it's hermeneutically flawed at the very foundational level, which we've all done. How many of you have put out fleeces to make decisions? I don't mean like wool on your front door, but like you've spoken in that kind of language. Well, I'm going to put out a fleece to see if God's going to do this or that. Oh, come on. You guys do this?
JG did. JG did. Okay.
You make a decision based on...
If then.
Yeah. God, I'm going to do this. And if you do this or if this happens, then I know that I need to do this. Come on, you guys make decisions. Are you
ready? Yeah, we
okay.
I do.
You know, where is that found? What narrative is that in?
Gideon.
Okay, where is Gideon found?
Judges.
What's the book of Judges all about?
People doing what's right in their own eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There's no king in Israel. The bookends of the book of Judges are, hey, you're going to read about a bunch of stuff that people did that was wrong. Now, let me tell you about it. I mean, this is not a book of examples to follow. Nothing in the book said, do this. Nobody, Jabez prayed a prayer. There's nothing in the context that says, now, I want everybody else to pray this prayer too. Buy the calendar, get the t-shirt, crochet the thing and put it on your whatever. pray this prayer and you'll be blessed too. Right. All it says is Jabez prayed this prayer and God blessed him. Not, therefore, go and do likewise, right?
Yeah.
Narrative, descriptive passages, they're not prescriptive unless something in the text tells you they are. Right? This is a fatal flaw for so much that's done in the Christian world. What do we learn from Jericho? Well, we need to...
March
around the walls of the thing that you're in the, trust God and blow the horns and we make all these like crazy analogies. What's the point? They did this. Who's the main character, particularly in Old Testament narrative?
God.
God is the main character. God's the main character. Some keys to narrative. Ask yourself, what is God doing in it? What is God doing in this passage? Even if he's not mentioned, what's he doing in this passage? And then watch the narrator. What is the narrator trying to communicate? In fact, one of the things Rick Holland used to tell us to do is, not really in your Bibles, but in your mind, sort of black out all the quotations. Because in the quotes is where all kinds of crazy people say all kinds of crazy stuff. The narrator's just recording what these crazy people are saying. Watch what the narrator says, because the narrator is the one that's actually driving the storyline. Hmm. He's going to tell you what the point is.
Hmm.
So, what is God doing in this, and what is the narrator trying to convey?
So I have a question then. Acts is a narrative book,
mm-hmm.
but there's all kinds of teaching that comes out of Acts that people are using to prescribe. Should we not do that?
There are didactic sections.
Okay.
There are teaching sections within narratives, right? The whole Mount Sinai deal, there's a narrative going on of this wandering in the wilderness, and then stop, do this, don't do this, don't do this, do this, etc.
Hmm.
The Gospels are like that too. Jesus takes time. Now, one of the things we're going to watch... when we talk about genre, we'll also talk about the place in the progress of Revelation. Scott, next Tuesday, will be teaching the class, talking about Old Testament to New Testament and the progress and how to read your Bible forward, right? And so he'll deal with that issue. How do we... I need to pay attention to commands when I'm told to do something. Now, how do I know this command is for me? Like, there are plenty of commands in the Bible, and if you just took all the imperatives and said, okay, I need to go do all these, get yourself in a lot of trouble, right? So how do I know this command is for me? We need to look at that too, and genre is going to help us, as well as it's where it sits in the Bible. What are some things that we need to, when we talk about some of these subsets, wisdom literature, prophetic literature, apocalyptic, gospels, epistles, all these things are going to function differently, but we still look at language and words the same way. We'll spend an entire day talking about metaphorical language and symbols, their use in poetry, and that kind of thing, and special rules for considering those things. You will not always, if you're, for instance, looking at, if you're looking at a long narrative, you're not gonna diagram necessarily every single, you're not gonna do clause by clause diagrams for a 3-chapter narrative, right? By the way, if you're telling a story, if you're gonna preach and you're gonna preach on some narrative, you may be covering 3 or 4 chapters of the Old Testament, and you don't really want to break it up and, you know, spend 6 months doing 3 chapters. You want to tell the whole story in one thing, or in 2, or whatever. You want to try to tell the whole story. That means if you've got 3 chapters, if you do clause by clause diagramming, you're going to spend your entire life diagramming it, and not doing all the other things you need to do with the passage. In that case, in narrative, one of the things that you'll learn to do is, you guys are getting quicker and good at your diagramming and recognizing things. What you're going to do in something like a long narrative passage is watch your conjunctions for coordination. Oh, subordination, something changed. Coordination, oh, subordination, something changed. You'll look at clause by clause as units, block diagramming. Okay. What we've been doing already is block diagramming, but with only 3 or 4 clauses. In a narrative passage, you're not going to take the time to go, okay, every prepositional phrase and all those little subparts. You're just going to say statement 1 or verse 1 or whatever is followed by 3 verses that give explanation. Verse 3, verse 4, verse 5. And they're all subordinate to that. Now, verse 6 comes back out here and continues the narrative. You'll give just a bigger block diagram. All of that to say, we're going to talk about 2 dangers with genre. You can overdo genre. And this is made huge with apocalyptic literature. Even in Gospels, here's what your commentaries, when you're reading your commentaries, will sometimes run crazy with genre discussion when it comes to Gospels. They will say a Gospel is an intentional theological device employed by its author to try to address specific situations in his audience in his time. So, for instance, the author of Matthew... If you ever see like the phrase, the author of the book of Matthew, instead of just calling him Matt or whatever, you're probably dealing with somebody who believes Matthew didn't write Matthew. Mm-hmm. The author of the Gospel of Matthew, why are you saying it that way? It's because he believes somebody else wrote it. And he believes that somebody else wrote it to a specific audience with specific theological intentions he's trying to get across. And it shapes the way he says things, it shapes what he says, so that it's no longer is a gospel a biography, an actual history. It's now a theological treatise using historical and maybe even some fudged details in order to get a point across. And you have to understand that when you come to gospels, because they're a different genre than, say, history or whatever. While we need to pay attention between the differences between Hebrew poetry and narrative and an epistle and why those things were written, the literature is so full of genre override as a way to get away from actual history. It's a way for liberal scholars to say, this is really, really cool literature. it doesn't matter if it's that, like, true or not. In fact, we don't necessarily have to hold the first century writers to a version of historical writing that conforms to the 20th century modern version of history writing. It was a different genre. Run from that garbage. And when you come to the book of Revelation, it's apocalyptic. So we don't look at the details. We look at the overarching flow and the whatever.
So when the book of Matthew, if somebody says the book Matthew wrote the gospel, his writing was written to Jews to show that Jesus was the king of the Jews. Mm-hmm. Is that incorrect?
No, because that stuff even comes out in Matthew's gospel.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's just observing what is the author's stated intention of the book. Okay. Or even implied intention. It's not always so clearly stated.
Okay.
When we get done with this, can we talk about the problem passage?
Yes, thank you. Absolutely. Why don't we do that now? Let's take a couple minutes. There is an assigned problem passage there. If you would like to consider doing a different problem passage,
we have some pre-approved, already decided upon passages that are okay.
Name it and claim it. If it's a difficult, debated, man, I don't know what's going on here text. So Genesis 6 is a potential problem passage. The sons of God and the daughters of men. Mm-hmm. any of the God changed his mind or God repented passages are up for grabs. Romans 7 and the identity of Paul. Is he a believer? Is he not a believer? Is he writing? Those are good. Anything else you guys have in mind, just make a suggestion.
Did you want something from a narrative, though?
Doesn't have to be.
Oh, okay.
No, like Romans 7's not.
Okay. About Hebrews 6, and I just transcript Mike Jones's sermon.
You may.
sure. That's actually our next one.
What's that?
Oh, that's the next one.
Yeah, that's the next one.
It's one of the problem passages.
Twice.
If you want to switch that and do the other one first, that's fine too.
So what are you looking for in that paper?
What I would like for you to do is turn in clause by clause diagram. Do as much research as you know how to do by the time you get to this paper. And the form of your paper should start with a diagram, with a statement of the problem or perceived problem. Here's why this is considered a problem passage. Then you should state all potential solutions to the problem, every interpretation. Crazy or not crazy, however people out there are trying to solve this problem. You know, there are six different answers, or seven, or maybe there's just two. But work hard at researching all possible. That means look at commentaries, get online. Don't ask your grandma what she thinks about it, that it needs to be published. give the pros and cons of each view, and they can be in the text, pros and cons, or out of the text, pros and cons. They can be theological, they can be whatever. I mean, if you have a view that solves a problem by going outside of the text to bring in a theological answer, we want to know that. We're not agreeing with the exegesis, but well, it does solve the problem, and it agrees with this theology thing or whatever. So all the pros and cons of every view, then pick a view and defend it.
Where is this Van Hoosen? Did you give that to us? The reading assignment for a couple of weeks from now?
No, I have not. I have not given that to you. I'll give that to you on Friday.
Also, I'm not going to be here on Friday, so can I do my homework and take a picture of it and send it to you?
Please do. It's great. Yeah. Others are doing that.
So clause by clause diagram on all the pros and cons, and then we put Which one we think it is?
Yeah, and you, that's going to demand, in a lot of cases, depending on your passage, word study. Basically, take your steps from H3 and work through all of those steps on your passage. And whatever turns up gold, as it were, bring that to the paper.
Yeah, it's 5 pages.
And feel free to use commentaries from step one on this, because you're going to need to interact with a lot of other views. Bring out their word study, etc. GG.
5 pages, double space, 12-point font.
You will probably need single space, 8-point font.
Does it have to be? Does it have to be?
Yeah. Like, what if it ends up 15 pages?
Yeah. Do you want it to be
a problem?
If you say double space and keep it under 10, better than 5. Okay. If you don't know how to do accurate citations, you need to figure that out.
Do you have a method you tend to like?
Turabian is a preferred.
Turabian. Citations in Turabian?
ML standard.
Okay, Turabian is actually the name of a person, Kate Turabian, who wrote a book on how to actually do this. Scott has a copy in his office. You can also get online. Logos.
Yeah, Logos will do them for you.
Logos will do them for you.
In Turabian format?
But you check it.
Yeah, Josh told me that it's wrong a lot.
Really?
Yeah. And it's inconsistent. It's nice that it brings all the information for you. You don't have to sit there and like, okay, italics, okay, no, this, no. It'll do it for you. But you just check it. Because Logos will cite the same exact work and do it two different ways. Whatever you do, be consistent. If you do it in Logos format, whatever they're using, they're not strictly Turabian, just be consistent. I'll notice it if you're inconsistent. If you're not using Turabian but you're consistent, I might not notice. Does that make sense? So just pay attention to that.
So is that MLA or?
Is that Major League Soccer?
No.
What is that?
MLA?
What's MLA?
Formatting, right? No.
I don't know.
Okay.
I've heard that somewhere before.
Yeah, it's like
everything you learn in high school and college.
Everything you learn in high school and college on how to cite a paper.
Great.
Okay.
If you know MLA, whatever that is.
It's long since been forgotten.
I have to reteach myself MLA, so I might as well do.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Great. Any other questions on that paper, guys?
Wow.
Look at your calendar, by the way. Do you have listed there? What's today? June 15th? 18th. We are here next Tuesday. That's the 22nd, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so sorry, guys. I needed to tell you that before.
Do we have anything due or anything like that?
And we're not here on the 29th.
I'm sorry.
We just change it then?
Just change the 29 to the 22. That bumps your RAM reading up, but don't bump it up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Don't change the RAM reading day. In fact, make RAM due on July 2nd.
Okay.
Sweet.
And that got changed because Scott's actually available on the 21st. And neither one of us is going to be available on the 29th. We'll be at Resolve.
So. Cool.
I was like, oh man, I have to Resolve. I have to drive all night and get here at 6.
Yeah, I know. That was not good thinking on my part.
So that means that the only thing that's due on the 22nd is Joel James?
Yeah, the only thing due on the 22nd is Joel James. And you guys will not be going over that in class. Scott's just going to use the whole time to talk about progress of Revelation, Old Testament to New Testament. So and remember, those Joel James assignments are self-correcting.
All right.
You should have all the right answers. It's 100% completion grade.
Did we turn those in last time? Or?
Yeah, you should have handed me a card.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You don't turn in an actual assignment. Unless you're Eric.
No, I'm getting the prom passage one.
Can you communicate all that to Denmark?
Oh yeah.
Thank you. I will. And I need to have Cassie run off the man who's reporting for me.
For the prom passage one, like now I would maybe lean towards doing a Roman thing because I would think that I'd be able to find that.